Welcome to another episode of Spanish History 101 brought to you by Brian Spain Domain. Up to this point, we have dealt mainly with the history of Spain and its European territory, which makes sense. But starting the end of the 15th century, as many know, Spain embarks, if you'll excuse the pun, on a very different history involving overseas exploration, territorial discoveries, and the eventual conquering of lands and empires, and the creating of an empire themselves. Some consider this to be the first global empire in history, the first to be called the empire where the sun never sets. But as we know, we are also talking about a very touchy and controversial topic, mainly due to the impact it had on the Americas, on the New World, and the indigenous populations there, in particular the abuses and the massive loss of life, and not to mention the cultural impact. And these will have to be addressed at some point. I will touch on it today, but I will focus mainly on the discovery years and the events themselves, because there is so much to talk about. We will need more podcast time because it's a very complex subject. Anyway, how did this all happen? Well, the general opinion is that the traditional routes to the east, to the Far East in Asia, the spice routes, had been cut off by the rise of the Ottoman Empire. And so, enterprising Europeans sought a different way around to get where they wanted to go so they can get the business that they wanted to get. None of these alternatives were easy, as they required lengthy voyages to mainly uncharted, or at, in the very least, very little known waters. The two countries to take the biggest interest in this initiative at first were Portugal and Spain, but especially Portugal under the supervision of the famous Prince Henry and his navigational school. Portugal focused on the routes down the coast of Africa. They didn't stray too far away from land that they were basically familiar with. And then they made it around the Cape of Good Hope and eastward to the Indies. The Spanish, on the other hand, took a little bit longer to get started. They had a number of issues on their plates during much of the 15th century. Civil wars, disputes of succession, economic woes, and a nagging issue which still hadn't been resolved for a very long time, which was what to do about that final Muslim kingdom in the south of Spain. On top of that, a great deal of its trade went in other directions. The Kingdom of Castile did business mainly with countries in the north of Europe in the wool sector, and the Crown of Aragon set its sights to the east in the Mediterranean, which experienced constant ups and downs in terms of success. The only possessions from beyond that area which the Spanish had taken an interest in were the Canary Islands. It took the Spanish a very long time to fully control them. They began in 1402 and didn't get the job finished until 1498. But once they had, these islands would turn out to be very, very important to them. In any event, plans to cross the Atlantic in search of a shorter route to the Far East came famously from a man with a dream named Christopher Columbus, who engaged in an intensive campaign to obtain the funding necessary to finance his voyage across an ocean whose dimensions were not really known. Columbus is said to have been originally from Genoa, but his origins are not really known 100%, and this mystery fascinates me. Because other suggestions like Portugal, Aragon, Catalonia, Valencia, the Balearic Islands, and even Galicia have been thrown out there, and a lot of them have not been entirely ruled out. It is also possible that he was actually born in Genoa, probably was, but that his parents were actually from somewhere else. In any event, the combinations seem limitless. Anyway, he was looking for money to pay for his trip, and the Catholic monarchs, Ferdinand and Isabella, I don't always use those two words, I prefer Fernando and Isabel, but this is such a traditional story, I'll sort of use their traditional names. They were hesitant, reticent, and wary of the proposal, because basically everything about it screamed risk. Columbus's estimate for the size of the planet was actually far smaller than reality, and in fact smaller than what Isabella's advisors were suggesting. They were actually more on the mark there. But eventually, Isabella decided to back the Italian adventurer with a modest three-caravel expedition into what was essentially the unknown. Now, the fact that it was Isabella and no one else was very important because that would make Castile originally the sole beneficiary of all the business that came into the peninsula from the Americas. And it would be like that for a long time. So that should give you an idea about what we're saying when sometimes when I talk about the unification of Spain during this period, what's true, but at the same time, they were separate entities. And here's a perfect example. But anyway, the discovery takes place. It's a story we all know well. Columbus and his three caravels leave from Palos de la Frontera in August of 1492, and in early October, just as things were getting dire, and they were about to abort the mission and turn around and go home, they sight land on October 12th. It was a sighting that would change the world forever. Now, we know this wasn't the first time Europeans had reached those lands. But there was little follow-up during those encounters, those moments in the past. And we obviously know that this is something that would have eventually taken place. But it happened to be the Spanish who got a huge head start on the rest of Europe. I mean, a very big head start. Other countries would timidly explore the coast of what would be called America. But it would be at least another 100 years or so before any other nation seriously succeeded in establishing a permanent settlement. And by that time, the Spanish had claimed as theirs vast portions of the continent. So it was a big difference. And it was also during these years that Portugal and Castile had this curious idea of dividing their future finds in half globally, in what came to be known as the Treaty of Tordesillas in 1494. It's sort of an unusual place because Tordesillas is also landlocked beyond belief. It's in the middle of the country. But anyway, these two countries decided to sort of delineate geographically whose lands would be whose. And this was approved by the Pope, who happened to be Spanish. No one really knew at that time what was out there, let alone the fact there was a whole new continent, which was going to be technically part of Castile's jurisdiction, or at least according to the Spanish and the Portuguese. But unfortunately for them, most other countries basically ignored the agreement. Regardless, both Portugal and Castile would pretty much have free rein over the newly found territories for a long time. Columbus's voyage would be the first of four trips to a land he was convinced was somewhere in Asia and apparently died under that impression. And he focused mainly on the Caribbean and the lands around the Caribbean as he sort of tried to get his head around just exactly where he was. Now, other missions were taking place at this time and a little bit later. One of the most famous was one led by Amerigo Vespucci, who traveled for the Portuguese and for the Spanish, and he wrote a number of books. And he was sort of the first one to realize, or at least to announce, that they weren't talking about Southeast Asia, but they were actually looking at an entirely new continent that was unknown to Europe. And that's when a German cartographer named Martin Waldseemüller made a map and named the new landmass after Vespucci in his honor, and they called it America. So some consider this to be sort of an unfair attribution, but then again, you have to admit there is some logic behind it. Now, once the Spanish figured this out and realized what they really had before them, there was almost no stopping the expansion. In the first 50 years of the 16th century, they explored and covered unbelievable stretches of land. It's almost inconceivable. Here is a shortened version. For example, in 1513, you had Núñez de Balboa from landlocked Extremadura, which happened to be where many of the conquistadors were from, would be credited with discovering the Pacific Ocean or being the first European to see it. At the time, he called it the South Sea. That same year, Ponce de León trekked around Florida and southeastern the United States. He would return to the area in 1521 and unfortunately be mortally wounded when attempting to set up the first Spanish colony in present-day United States. A lot was happening in those years. In 1519, Fernando Magellan embarked on an ambitious mission to circumnavigate the world. He succeeded, but partially. And what I mean by that is that his fleet actually managed to complete the trip, but he himself was killed halfway through in the Philippines. A subordinate of his, Sebastian Elcano from the Basque Country, would lead the expedition for the rest of the voyage. Of the 270 members of the crew on the trip at the beginning, only 19 made it back. It must have been a grueling adventure. 1519 was also the year that Spain took a major leap forward in its conquests by penetrating what is today Mexico and conquering the Aztec Empire under the command of Hernán Cortés. It wasn't an easy operation by any stretch of the imagination, but given the lopsided numbers, heavily in favor of the locals, it was a miracle the Spanish expedition wasn't slaughtered and instead ended up victorious. 10 years later, in 1531, Pizarro would overtake the Incas in the Andes of Peru in extremely difficult terrain. In 1539, Francisco de Ulloa sailed up the Gulf of California and around California, the Baja California, and this is when he discovered that that was a peninsula. In 1539 to 1543, Hernando de Soto explored much of what is present-day southern United States. He became the first to cross the Appalachians and even the Mississippi River. During those same years, basically, Francisco Vázquez de Coronado, basically known as Coronado, would travel to the southwestern part of the United States and eventually reach the Grand Canyon. And also in 1541 and 1542, Francisco de Orellana would sail down the length of the Amazon River. And that's just to name a few. There are many more. So by 1550, the Spanish had managed to at least explore many, many parts of the American continent. In a certain way, you have to admit that these are pretty impressive operations given the reduced size of the Spanish numbers involved and the many challenges they faced, not just enemy peoples and civilizations. But disease, climate, new plants and animals, and the terrain, especially the jungle, would have been something they were not familiar with at all. And it must have been very challenging for them. The Spanish had technology on their side, there's no doubt about that. Perhaps a bit of superstition that favored them. They also seemed pretty good at dividing their enemies so that they went after each other or would ally with the Spanish. So that was part of the secret to their success. Castile had a number of plans in mind. They wanted to evangelize, increase prestige, and find precious metals like gold and silver. As they put it succinctly, gold, God, and glory. Now, I don't know who coined that phrase, but that could almost describe much of the European motives for many centuries during the colonization period throughout the world. Now, one thing that was interesting about the Spanish is that they had sort of a particular system for their new possessions. It's important to remember that they were not considered colonies. Spain, that is Castile, considered them to be a part of the country, royal territory, and the inhabitants were given, in theory, equal status as subjects of the monarchy. In fact, Queen Isabella in 1501 banned slavery there based on that premise. Slavery was not allowed in Spain, therefore, slavery cannot be allowed in the land where the people who live there are her subjects. And that included the native inhabitants of the Americas. But we will soon see that the exploitation didn't end there, and slavery was actually continued through a completely independent source. In any event, the fact that the Spanish incorporated the peoples of these lands, as well as evangelized them, would serve to create a sort of strong bond between the two for many centuries. But that shouldn't take away from the fact that it was a horribly rough time for the natives in many ways. The first decades were particularly hard for the native inhabitants. Untold numbers would die from disease, mainly disease, which they had no natural defenses against, and exploitation. The Spanish employed a labor system called encomiendas, which were grants given to individuals, conquistadors, soldiers, who would then exploit the land given as well as the people on the land and living there. It was like sort of creating automatic lordships. Once again, in theory, the owners were supposed to treat these people well, with respect. They were supposed to help with their education and care for them. But that clearly didn't happen very often in practice, or that's what it seems. That doesn't mean that the Spanish weren't aware of this. The Burgos Laws of 1512 and the new laws of 1541, enacted by Ferdinand II and Charles V, respectively, were serious attempts to eradicate labor abuses and mistreatment, but it was difficult for the homeland to ensure that they were correctly enforced. As expansion increased almost exponentially, the Spanish decided to organize their territories for logical reasons. It was just too much for a kingdom in Europe to administer efficiently. They created what were called viceroyalties, which were kind of like sub-kingdoms, which had a lot of home rule powers, but still had to answer ultimately to the monarchy back in Spain. The first was actually called the Indies, but that was short-lived, and the next two big viceroyalties were known as New Spain and Peru. Economically speaking, the Spanish were highly interested in obtaining gold and silver as a source of wealth, neither of which at first was as abundant as they were hoping for. Eventually, mines were found in Mexico, and then the mother lode of them all, the Potosí Mountain in Peru, was located, and which to this day still churns out silver. It's amazing. All administrative decisions were made through the Casa de Contratación in Seville, and then later the Council of the Indies. All voyages to the Indies had to be approved by this office, and we will see later on why this would complicate matters for Spain. And that is all for now. That's a lot. I mean, it's a lot to talk about, but we have to take a break, and we'll carry on with another episode on Spanish History 101 in the future. You can subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Apple, Amazon, and Castos, or if you wish to support Brian's Spain Domain, we'd greatly appreciate it. We work very hard to provide you with the very best information about Spain, Spanish history, Spanish culture. You can do so by clicking on our PayPal donate button, or if you want to have access to absolutely all of our podcasts and support us regularly, you can check us out on Patreon at the link provided below. Stay well, stay safe, and hasta pronto.